Throaty roar from the bored and stroked inline six of Buzz's 51 Hudson wingback turned heads went wherever he went, and it was no different when he and Nancy pulled into Bob's Big Boy on West Alameda for a couple of burgers. He gave the engine a couple of gratuitous revs before shutting it off. Then he rolled down the window to greet Muffy as she strolled cat-like toward the car in the tightest imaginable pantaloons.
Good evening and welcome to Shay Roberts Le Grand Garçon. My name is Muffin and I will be your server this evening. May I show you our wine list?
Buzz gaped at her, not comprehending.
Hey, cut it out, Muffy. We was just coming in for a cheeseburger, wasn't we, Nance? Maybe it's sarsaparilla,
His voice trailed off and he shrugged. Maybe she was trying out for a play or something. Well, he could play along, too. Doing his best Humphrey Bogart imitation, he said,
"Oh, what the heck? What you got on tap?"
That's Humphrey Bogart?
That's my Humphrey Bogart.
Oh, okay. Muffy paused to crack her gum.
Babe, looking at you.
Muffy paused.
You never said it that way, though.
Right. Muffy paused.
What'd you do?
To crack her gum.
Oh, yeah.
And clear her throat.
We have a very nice Bordeaux, a 1787 Chateau Lafite, goes real swell with the meatloaf, also a groovy white, a 1948 Montrachet from Domaine de la Romanée Conti. Oh, I recommend that if you're having a tuna noodle dandy or the fish witch. And my personal favorite, I'm changing my accent now for you, the Chateau Mouton Rothschild 1945 comes in a 4-liter Jeroboam shaped like a pancreas, but we serve it in sparkly blue plastic tumblers with Chez Robert's jerky-flavored swizzle sticks.
She lowered her voice conspiratorially.
Tastes a little like chicken, if you want to know the truth.
Buzz fidgeted. He didn't want to let on to Nancy that all those fancy wine words went right over his head. Luckily, his buddy, Eugene, parked next to him in his big white Packard, chose that moment to put his 2 cents in.
Hey, Buzz!
He said.
No matter what she says, stay away from the 51 Chateau Hot Brian Pissac Leonion. Yeah, I thought I was drinking pledge!
Muffy bristled.
I told you, Eugene, not to have it with the coleslaw, but you wouldn't listen. Oh, no, you... Excuse me?
Nancy. That's Nancy interrupted.
Even I really have my heart set on the mirror. How about that Petrus Pomerol I've heard so much about?
There you go.
The one that's extremely fruity with suggestion of berries, vanilla, mocha, and oak, and that finish.
She smacked her lips.
It's really something to wait for as it caresses the palate, especially with Le Grand Garçon's great onion rings.
Buzz gaped at Nancy, then recovered.
Sure, that's what we'll have,
he said importantly.
And bring us 2 straws, please.
Muffy jotted down the order in her notebook, then sashayed back to the restaurant, her hips swaying back and forth like a couple of spongy bongo drums that Buzz had long yearned to play. A sudden explosion rocked the Big Boy parking lot, violently shaking the Hudson and eliciting a shriek from Nancy.
What was that?
Buzz glanced over at the cavernous hole in the pavement where the big Packard had been parked a minute before.
Guess Eugene's Bulbarigma's finally got the better of him, poor guy.
Muffy reappeared from Le Grand Garçon, carrying a tray on which were balanced a glass bottle and a bowl of sizzling onion rings. In place of a cork, the bottle sported a velvet nose. Nancy moaned appreciatively when she saw it, so Buzz remained silent in his ignorance. Muffy locked the tray onto the half-rolled-up driver's side window, then gently pressed the bottle's nostrils together. Once, twice, three times, until it sneezed, spewing tiny drops of Petrus Pomerol Merlot up into the air. Instantly, the tongues of all three were out, licking the air clean of any wine particulate matter. Then Muffy showed the bottle to Nancy, a bit too theatrically, thought Buzz, and handed it to her with a straw. Nancy bit off the tip of the straw and inserted it into the bottle. She sucked demurely, savoring the wine's power from the rich soil on which the grapes grew. She leaned back, sighed, and nodded appreciatively to Muffy, who next handed Buzz a straw. He tried to bite off the tip, too, but he didn't get the tooth-to-straw angle right, and it just bent unappetizingly. Embarrassed, he hastily jammed it into the bottle and began to suck ferociously. Nothing happened. He sucked again, even harder this time. Still nothing. Examining the straw, he saw an embolus where he'd bent it. He tried to massage it out, but it wouldn't budge, so he popped the straw back into the bottle and blew hard. The melodic obstruction was expelled with such force that it burst through the bottom of the bottle, which Nancy was still holding on her lap.
Oh, no!
She exclaimed. However, the operative word was really...
Yes!
Yes, the wonderfully fruity wine had exploded all over her spanking clean white dress, leaving nothing to wash down the onion rings with, thought Buzz as he absentmindedly chewed his straw to a pulp. Muffy produced a moist towelette and tried to sop up the spilt Petrus Pomerol. By chance, she rubbed the towelette against the bottle, and a genie suddenly appeared in a puff of mocha and oak-scented smoke.
Who summons me?
He said in a voice full of big, silky tannins and a long, smoky aftertaste. Not unlike Eugene's, thought Buzz as he retreated from the genie's halitosis.
Sorry, genie,
said Muffy.
I must have rubbed the bottle by mistake, but as you can see, we've made an awful mess of your lovely wine. Can you help us clean it up?
The genie surveyed Nancy's dress. Buzz thought that his eyes rested a bit too long on her supple form, then snapped his fingers. Instantly, the red stains vanished. Unfortunately, so too did Nancy, Buzz, the Hudson wingback, and the plate of onion rings.
Oh, genie, you've really done it this time,
said a very cross Muffy. Coincidentally, this time is also Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar's 491st. There's... We're listening to Muffy.
A full-bodied
masterpiece of a radio show that beguiles the senses with a complex array of alluring scents, flavors, and even Calvos.
Ah, so indeed. My, you gave me too many people to know.
Six people. Plus a nose.
In one essay. And the phone rang for like over about 3 minutes as somebody is trying to reach us.
Or
as
some...
if they have any clue that we're not live.
Yeah, right.
Oh, my goodness. Well, in the background, we're listening to a combination of Guillermo Galindo and our guest today on Calvos and Damien, Chris Brown. And Guillermo kind of ran out and started speaking in something or other.
Tongues. Or noses.
Yes, and then we ended up with just the little Chris Brown bit left over, which is from an LP, actually. It's a thing called Branches. We're just listening a little bit.
It sort of ties in with the show today.
It does. The interview with Chris Brown. Is that
who?
What I said?
Oh, did you?
I may have said that.
Oh,
our
good.
Guest today on Calvos and Damien. Our guest today on Calvos and Damien.
Our
this
guest
is a long,
today?
Yes, this is a long interview. It may spill over into next week for those of you who will be tuning in for Ernesto Diaz Infante next week. It's also WGDR fundraiser next week. So we may just sort of juggle our schedule around one more time.
We like juggle so well.
Yes, we like to do that. Almost done with our interviews from California. So let's listen a little bit more of this Chris Brown, and then we'll I don't know. It's long. Maybe we'll go right to the interview. What do you think?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. All right. A little bit more of this music here, this Branches stuff by Chris Brown. We'll be back just before the interview to say something coherent.
That's us. Bit of Chris Brown from an old LP. Actually, the LP, interestingly enough, is not that old. The LP was manufactured only about 2 years ago. Ah.
But I guess it's hip now to be LP'd.
Vinyled.
Vinyl, yeah.
So this is where we say something, what?
Nothing intelligent. No, we're going out to Chris Brown. This is recorded in Jerry Gerber's studio, which I think you'll recognize right away by the sounds in the background.
August 2003.
2003, yes. I think in the future we should probably avoid recording 50 interviews in a batch because they get to be like a little antique. But it's always fun.
Sure.
We're an archive site now, aren't we?
I think so.
All right, let's head out to California and Chris Brown.
It's Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar on the road. We're here in San Francisco. We're talking to a composer who was an inspiration to both Calvos and Damien in the course of their careers, someone whose work has been out there as kind of you've been an unpaid mentor for many of us. So I'm sorry, I'm not handing it over any cash.
Oh, okay. Maybe another day. Huh?
our guest today is Chris Brown. Welcome to Calvos and Damien.
Thank you very much. It's great to be talking to you.
If you will, be so kind as to give us your bio, your history, the sort of highlights of your developments and your inventions, if you will, and tell our audience what it would be, what might be the reasons that we found your work inspiring over the years.
Well, I guess the main pursuit that I've been following for a long time has been the idea of the composer as instrument builder. And I really began my interest in experimental music when I was an undergraduate at UC Santa Cruz. And including some students that were active in that area, I ran into these great mentors, William Brooks, who was for a long time a teacher at Illinois Champaign-Urbana, a great composer, and Gordon Mumma. And that's where I first saw live electronic music performance and met a composer who was building circuitry and essentially, you know, creating the sound for each piece from scratch. And
that would have been about when?
That was 74, 75. I was in Santa Cruz from 70 to 75. I'd grown up in Chicago and had done a classical piano background and began to pursue that in college and then ran into this other kind of music that just blew my mind. I started reading John Cage and at that point decided that was really where I wanted to go. And so after that, I sort of was involved with piano performance for most of the 70s and extended piano, got interested in improvising.
Extended piano meaning?
Well, playing inside. I did a lot with the music of Henry Cowell at that time.
Sure.
Yeah, I did a little prepared piano, but not really into the literature of that as much.
Like Cowell pieces like the Banshee, the famous where you play inside.
Exactly. I discovered the Cowell record that was on Folkways.
Uh-huh, yes.
And I think it must have been about 73 or something that I found
That's
out about.
That's where Cowell plays himself and actually in the Banshee actually introduces it.
Right.
With
right.
that wonderful nasal voice.
Right, and just love the music, you know. It was so different but yet so accessible and so folkloric in a certain way, which has always been something that appealed to me about certain aspects of especially American experimental music. And it also sort of had a local connection because Cowell used to wander the Santa Cruz hills and the energy of that I was feeling at that time, having come from the big city, you know, Chicago in the Midwest, out to the West Coast into this gorgeous landscape, I just connected with it. And the piano sounds that he was getting, the physicality of playing Cowell's music is not something you get just from hearing a record. And I just, you know, playing tone cluster music with your shoulders and arms,
yes,
it's like an athletic event, really. And I really got into that. And I happened to meet Olive Cowell, who was Henry Cowell's stepmother, and I played in her home in San Francisco, where she had a concert hall built for Henry Cowell, basically, to play this music. And met Lou Harrison. I sort of made these connections with people. You know, John Cage came through Santa Cruz because he was hanging out with Norman O'Brown. That was sort of the 70s part. Then I got out of college and started moving up to the Bay Area and did a little more piano work, but I was sort of moving towards electronics. I knew I wanted to study electronics, but I was not really scientific or technical by mm-hmm. nature.
Right.
I hadn't grown up with that. I was more sort of into the, you know, the music and the poetry and that literature, that side of things. And so one of my friends from college essentially tutored me in building your own circuitry.
Uh-huh.
And there was a group at that time
called... You were working in analog and...
Analog,
both,
yeah.
Just analog at the time.
Yeah, I was not clear on what digital was even, you know. I mean, actually, I'd done a little bit with computer stuff. But in those days, it was like taking a stack of punch cards and throwing it into the bin and coming back the next morning
after
it'd run on the mainframe, you know. That was where it was at in the early 70s. But this friend of mine was in a group that started at UC San Diego called Confluence. And the principle of that group was that all the players built all the instruments that made the sounds. Nothing else was allowable. You had to build your own instrument.
Acoustic and electronic?
Well, they were electroacoustic, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
They'd been influenced by David Tudor
and
learned about contact microphones. And they started experimenting with metals and different kinds of surplus, putting them together with the contact microphones, and then starting to build circuits like mixers and filters and things like that to alter the sounds. But they were physical objects. They were sculptural. And essentially I joined that group when the group moved up to San Francisco and immersed myself in learning how to solder and build instruments. And to me it seemed like a natural thing sort of in the Partch tradition, you know, that we're going to start from scratch, we're going to use the materials that are around us, we're going to make music with that. The music's going to reflect the environment we're in.
I'm sure some of our listeners' heads have just snapped up saying, wait a minute, instruments, soldering iron, I don't understand. Instruments, rosin,
well,
strings, I understand.
That's the point, you know, is that what is the technology of today, or what is the world we're living in? At this point, it's dominated. It was already, you know, clear that it's very much electronic. I mean, my first musical experience that I remember is with my head next to a loudspeaker.
That's true. You know, I think almost all of us,
right.
That was our first musical experience. And I think now
from
infancy, it's true. So I don't think anyone would have any question about that. It's just the adjustment that...
I love acoustic music and I love concerts,
it.
You know.
Yeah, but you make it that way.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I love acoustic music and concerts and concert hall. On the other hand, I realize that that's about, you know, at best 5% of my experience of hearing music. I mean, not counting the part where I'm playing it myself,
yes.
but right. You know, yeah, all of our experiences either through the radio or through recorded media. I mean, and they're often reflections of acoustic situations, but yet there's that medium again. And so I just felt as a composer that was there to be dealt with. And certainly seeing Gordon Mumma deal with it in a highly virtuosic way, I don't know if his contribution to the development of live electronic music is really widely enough appreciated. I'll say it isn't.
It is not. No, yeah. I think the name is probably not very well known, except
right.
for certain collaborative pieces where his name is attached to others,
right.
And that were actually where recordings were issued. The coasts may remember the name,
right.
In certain areas of the Midwest where he worked, but
it was pioneering work. I mean, the fact is that there are probably only a few films of his pieces in performance, but having seen them, they were incredible interactive electronic music pieces.
Describe one of them. So
well, for example, his piece Hornpipe, where he's playing all kinds of reeds and noisemakers into the French horn. He's an accomplished French horn player and played in orchestras and such, but he was using the horn as a resonance chamber,
right.
And basically putting these broadband noises into a space. He built what was essentially an analog computer that he wore on his belt, and he would move around the space tethered with a tether to his electronic equipment, basically putting these broadband spectra out into the space, and the circuit that he was wearing would analyze the response of the room to that broadband sound and gradually build up information about it. And by the time it had developed some kind of a picture of it, would start to feed back at the resonances of the room. Now, this is an incredibly complex system that most of the, you know, users these days of Max MSP or Super Collider or whatever, you know, to accomplish that kind of thing is very difficult even with the high-end tools we have. He's doing it with a soldering iron and transistors. I mean, I'm still in awe. And plus, it was a spectacular live performance event. You know, it just was something to watch as well as to listen to.
So it makes perfect sense that within the context of who we are today, that building an instrument is probably going to lean in the direction of building a device that is powered in some way versus some sort of squeeze box.
Well, yeah, I don't mean that there aren't things to do acoustically. Obviously, there are.
No, I'm just.
But in terms of
setting out the
what you're saying, I basically felt was true, that this is where the resources of the culture are going, and this is where a lot of work remains to be done. You know, if we can really take this new potential and make something new out of it, rather than trying to recreate what the old music was.
And so where did you begin taking this when you started working with it?
Okay, so I was working with this group Confluence, and we were doing improvisational music with electroacoustic amplified equipment. And that went on for a while. We did some wonderful events with it.
But you said everybody had to build something. What did you do?
I built one of the instruments. One of the instruments I built was called the Hot Lunch. It was built out of a plastic lunch tray like you get in the cafeteria, you know, that kind of rectangular shape.
Yep.
And I basically put a little... I cut into it so that it had a little bit of a neck. So the bottom of it looked like a lunch tray and the top part tapered to a point. And then I built a little piece of wood fingerboard and turned it into a fiddle that I played on my knee. So it was kind of upright, like some of the, there's a Greek instrument called the lyra that's played that way. It was kind of modeled on that idea. It had four strings on it, but on the lunch tray, the main thing was it was a percussive surface. And I put all kinds of things that could be scraped or rubbed with the fingers to create kind of guica-like sounds. Mm-hmm. And the sound of all these noisemakers on the tray would go into the tray, get picked up by the contact microphone, and be really loud. And you could use them as kind of an interesting noise source. And
was it monaural? Was it spatial? Did you have multiple microphones?
No, it was just $1.
We're in the early days.
Piezo, like
Radio
yeah.
Shack.
Yeah, but then
gold colored, right?
Not Radio Shack, actually. Better than that, but. Anyway, that was one. But I was also making there was a lot of instruments in the group that were made with sheets of stainless steel balanced on balloons, and this was an innovative technique that a composer named Prent Rogers came up with. A balloon is a great surface for making a piece of metal right. resonate for a long time.
Prent Rogers does a lot of wonderful microtonal music today
yeah.
as well. Continues to work highly experimentally as well as lush sounds.
I'd like to hear about what you know, because I haven't been in touch with him for a while. I'd love
Prent Rogers is a good presence on mp3.com.
Okay. I'll go there. Anyway, I made electric versions of these instruments. So you'd put the contact microphone in between the plate. And I had sort of a wing-shaped piece of steel with bronze brazing rods attached to it. And then I would play those with a bow. So I would bow the rod, and the sound would go into the plate and make a very resonant kind of singing tone that way. And then eventually I sort of went back to the idea, you know, being a pianist, I was sort of starting to miss the physical mm-hmm. interactivity that I had with that instrument. And I was also at the time learning how to surviving tuning pianos and rebuilding them and such.
No.
So I had all these guts of pianos around me. So I said, well, I've got to turn this into an instrument. So I made this instrument called a gazamba, which was essentially an electric prepared piano using pickups from Fender Rhodes. And I took one section of an upright piano action and built a little small keyboard with, I think, about 24 keys on it. And each of the keys hit different metal pieces of junk, springs, pieces of spring steel, a little bit of strings that were kind of prepared very roughly with all kinds of different objects. So I had a percussion piano that was just set up only for that purpose. And I used it in the group. And then eventually I started writing pieces for the instruments. One of the earliest compositions that I got performed and got some notice for was called Alternating Currents. And actually just was released this year.
Yes.
Re-released. Well, I don't think it was ever really released.
Oh.
I mean, I sent out cassettes of it. Maybe you got one at one point.
I may have one. I know the piece from before the release.
Wow. So. Anyway,
underground, you know, your royalties are still coming.
It was sort of the thing where Kent Nagano, who is the conductor that conducts a lot of Messiaen and a lot of other contemporary music, went to school at the same time as I did at UC Santa Cruz, and we knew each other from there. And he had just gotten this appointment at the Berklee Symphony, and he was looking around, sort of in the mode of Messiaen for orchestral pieces that used invented instruments, because Messiaen, of course, did also.
Right.
And so he asked me if I'd come up with something, because I told him what I was doing. And so I wrote this piece, Alternating Currents, for the symphony, and I included parts for the gazamba and for the wing, and also for percussion soloist and so forth. So actually, the recording that just came out is a synthesized version of that orchestra piece, but with the solo parts enhanced in electronics, and it's out on an ecstatic piece. And maybe we'll hear it. This point?
That would be a great thing to hear. Let's hear it right now. Alternating Currents, our guest is Chris Brown.
Shena! I'm Howard Fredericks, and you're listening to Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar, your one stop for non-pop flotsam and jetsam on the Non-Pop International Network.
Here on WGDR, Plainfield, Flotsam and Jetsam.
That could be us, except
yes.
Calvus and Damien's Flotsam and Jetsam.
And we're going to hear that Chris Brown piece in just a second. I should mention that you can hear that our interview is a little dated because we talk about Prent Rogers being on mp3.com, which between the time we recorded that interview and today has went belly upon its upness, and then it followed that by being reconstituted as some sort of pay-for-play site that nobody goes to.
Exactly.
So yes. Anyway, that's the deal. And what were you going to say?
Was I? Oh, flagship, maybe?
Of?
The?
Non-Pop International Network. Yeah. What else?
Oh.
Oh.
Oh, that was oh. That was the wrong thing. Now we're going to listen to Alternating Currents by Chris Brown. That's interesting because this was an LP that I actually transferred over to CD because it's just so hard to carry the LPs without crushing them these days. So it was only released about 3 years ago. So we're going to hear the transfer of a Virgin LP to a Virgin CD.
Oui,
what
vinyl.
Do you think?
Vinyl CD?
Yes, indeed. What other kind? Thank you.
LP, here we are. We're back, having heard the LP of Alternating Currents. This is a wonderful.
It was interesting because Thurston Moore, who is the producer of this series and of the label, of course, when this came about, you know, I was a little bit skeptical. Why are we putting it on LP? And then I heard it. He was saying, well, this is a collector's series, and we do only the finest pressings. Blew me away. I was reconvinced that LP sounds in a certain way more natural.
Yeah, I mean, that's been said over and over, and I think it has to do with some of the sort of naturalness of using a physical motion versus a reconstruction interpolation.
Right. I think that's in the recording somehow. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of hocus pocus, and I don't usually subscribe to hocus pocus, but I was, you know.
It colors it. And it colors it in a way which is warm, and it's always been said, and it is absolutely true.
Right.
Yeah.
So I, in a way, that sort of brings back what's been important for me in a lot of my music is keeping while you're using electronics, not thinking that the entire music is in the electronic domain only, you know, that it really comes about through physical gesture and also through electroacoustic transpositions. And that was also, I think, part of the David Tudor tradition of electronics, is that it really isn't about sort of abstracting the music in the electronic mode. It's about using the electronic, the sound that the electronic medium provides as a new resource, as a new kind of an experience.
Yeah, it can remain very much a physical experience, and that also helps it be an effective performance experience. I mean, it's pretty deadly to when you go to a performance when the extent of the physical event is a mouse and key clicks.
Yes, I mean it's a problem such that I think that we're moving towards a kind of musical environment now for electronic music that is moving away from the stage. I mean, it just is not interesting to watch laptop players on stage.
No, it isn't.
I mean, the best you can do is usually close your eyes. And
it doesn't mean the music is uninteresting.
Absolutely
it's just
not.
We have no sort of performance paradigm for electronic music.
So it makes more sense that the audience not be confined to hearing it from one point of view. That's sort of been my solution to that particular idea. And I guess that leapfrogs us up to the present, but...
Well, why not?
Do we want to do that, or should we go a little more linearly here?
We can skip back as time allows.
Okay.
Let's talk about it.
Well, just since we're on that some of one of the latest projects that I've been doing is with the composer Guillermo Galindo, and this is a project called the Transmission Series. And basically it's taking this idea that electronic music again, is a physical medium, and it depends a lot on the way that the sound is actually transduced into the space. And what I got interested in the idea of using radio as radio transmitters as channels for electronic music, and having the audience be able to pick up that with their own personal radios. So the idea is we perform quadraphonic music, but each one of the channels in the quad is going to a different FM radio transmitter. And these are little 6-watt transmitters that will work, you know, depending on how they're installed, anywhere from a block to a couple of miles. Basically, we perform in an installation in which the audience is partly the sound system. Because they bring their radio, we give each one of them a frequency, they become one channel in the composition, and they move with their radio around and change the relationship of the sound as it's being created live to the other channels, and create this sort of multi-focal mix. Some people always think quad, okay, or 5.1, this is a way to really control the experience for the audience. This is kind of emphasizing the opposite. This is a way to make the audience part of an experience in which everybody is part of the control system, and it's not the composer imposing a spatialization on the music or on the audience, but the audience participating in the process of hearing multi-source
portable electronic music. Sort of portable audience performer has also been explored by Phil Klein in New York. He does some pieces for boomboxes,
right,
in which there are identical recordings given to each person, but because of the variations in speed among
I did one of those actually in
quite lovely
in the 70s at San Francisco Art Institute. I had that same idea and took the class out to a shopping center with the boomboxes and had them all start together and move out. You kind of get this choreography of the sound, and then you start getting delays as the boomboxes go out of sync. It was
gorgeous.
And
it changes the space as things move. It's really quite a wonderful concept. The whole idea of involving an audience as kind of a not only an unwilling performer, which was part of the avant-garde tradition, but here a kind of a willing performer and a creative performer.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, just the same way I think Tudor moved towards sound installation and really was pioneered that medium in the 70s, where he sort of moved away from doing pieces on stage. I mean, he'd already been working with dance, of course, where you have this multimedia sort of idea, but he started creating Rainforest, for example, where you have this, you know, installation of objects that are sounds are being passed through, and the audience can move around within and get different vantage points on, and really become part of the whole performance. I think this is really where, you know, this kind of thing is where electronic music is going, even in the popular medium, where, you know, with DJs and various kinds of dance clubs and such, where you've got different music going on in different places and audiences moving through. I think that's a compositional medium at this point, and that's one that aspect of it that I'm really interested in right now. And so we've been doing this.
How many times have you done this?
We've done about 5 different ones.
Same material?
No, different every time. The first one was in Mexico City for part of a radio festival. So it was the perfect launch for that, and we just barely got the equipment running, and it was great. It was an evening outside in the plaza. A lot of times it works better outside. And then we did it here in about a year ago in a meadow at Mills College at twilight. So that was we used more natural sounds at that point. The first one in Mexico City, we'd use texts a lot that were transformed as part of the electronically as part of the performance. And one of them was in Spanish, one in English, and there was kind of a dialogue going on between the texts. The one at which was called Transmission Temescal. Temescal is a neighborhood in Oakland. We're focusing on the natural environment of Oakland and the California environment, and at the same time the frogs were going and the crickets and everything. So it sort of melted into the landscape that way.
Does the system you've created to do this provide sort of a feedback to itself as it's working, or is this exclusively transmitted outward and then sort of mixed by your audience?
It can provide some feedback. I think we were not working very much with live microphones, but that's a good idea. That is a good idea. Maybe we'll have to extend that. But actually, we have a recording that maybe we can play now of Transmission Temescal that was done a few few days, maybe a week or so later, on what's called the Art Ship, which is a ship that was parked in one of the berths in Oakland and was used for art events for quite a long time, for a couple years. And a guy named Hugh Livingston, who's an active cellist and composer in the area, was doing a series of musical events on the ship. And so we did one from there. And that's where I found out that actually these 6-watt transmitters can go several miles, because one of the participants was in the show and left a little bit early and drove back to his home and kept the a channel on the radio and got it all the way 6 miles away. So,
wow. Along the flat surface of the
anyway, we have a little mini CD of that, and maybe we could listen to a bit of that.
Sounds great. Transmission Tennisco. This is Chris Brown and Guillermo Galindo also?
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Chris Brown and Guillermo Galindo with Transmission Temescal.
Temescal.
I keep wanting to switch languages, too.
Yeah, well, that's something that's going on in the neighborhood. And actually, one of the transmission that we're really looking forward to now is Transmission Mission. And the Mission District in San Francisco.
We
just got a grant from a local foundation to produce an event downtown San Francisco at the Yerba Buena Gardens, which is an outdoor sort of public park area where there are performance series that goes on in the summer. So next summer, early summer, we're going to do a transmission that involves recorded sounds from the Mission District, which is the district in San Francisco that culturally is the center of the Latino community.
It sounds like this opens up all sorts of possibilities of for example, using live microphones and feeding the system back and then transmitting it out and then having kind of a long delay loop as it's working so that the material it recurs and is retransmitted and heard again and then picked up by the system with new sounds. And I mean, the opportunities to make kind of an ongoing and constantly mutating environment out of these sounds seem just marvelous.
That's a great idea. Maybe you'd like to come out and help us do it.
I'd love to come out.
As you can imagine, it's pretty complex already with these transmitters and everything, and getting the audience to realize what's happening. So interesting in this project that, as you know, it's hard to describe, but the experience of it, as soon as people experience it, they say, oh, that's what you meant. You know, oh, okay. It's kind of simple once you get it going. But to actually communicate the concept, people don't have the idea with radio. I'm sure you know, it comes out of the ether and who knows where it comes from. And even to get people into the idea that there's something going on live here that is creating this sound that they're receiving.
Radio has always been, and radio considerations have always been kind of a compositional, I don't know, stepchild, if you will. They have been with us not only since the days of broadcasting, but also radio-controlled devices like the theremin. Radio is
absolutely
a really important part of who we are as composers.
Right, and especially of the electronic music, the history of electronic music and support for electronic music. I mean, one thing we don't have in the U.S. is much of a sense of radio art, you know, and that, of course, is much more of a presence in Latin America and in Europe, where there are commissions specifically for pieces to be done on radio, and that's what part of this radio festival was, that we went there to Mexico to start this piece with. And so I think we as radio producers, I actually have a show on KPFA here, we need to keep reminding people that exists. And actually I'd like to give a tip of the hat to I'm spacing out the name, Free Radio Berkeley, freeradioberkeley.org. Is a website where you can get information about how to make your own radio transmitters. And it's been around for 15, 20 years. It's a real Berkeley, you know, liberation idea of empowering people by giving them access to the media. And they make kits that can be purchased by anybody, but especially they bring them to third world places so that people locally can have ways of creating their own radio stations and create community with the radio. So really, I'm using their kits to do this, and it was a great education into what radio technology is like.
This may be a sidestep, but what's your feeling about the whole status of radio in the States right now, particularly the deregulation question that's come up?
Well, yeah, deregulation, but deregulation
meaning,
is essentially meaning the majors gobble up everything.
Another thing about radio is that it's one of the limited resources that we have because of the nature of it. There's only so much transmission that occurred within a geographical area.
What's interesting about
the government has protected those for many years from monopolistic practice.
Right. It's interesting what this project has given me an insight on this whole issue, which is that, just to start with, if I set up in my room or in my backyard with a 6-watt radio transmitter and I raise up my antenna high enough, I can really dominate and sit on the same frequency as some commercial station. I can dominate my local area because I'm closer to my own antenna than I am to their antenna. So, in fact, it is a very uncontrollable medium if people actually had access to transmitter technology. And what's really regulated and which is not being unregulated is that. So this is a political issue, actually.
Yes.
It's really about if people knew and had access to the technology where they could make their own, you know, broadcast their own programs and their own information, they wouldn't, we'd have a huge proliferation of sources of information and great stuff. And so I'm kind of an advocate for this point of view. And, you know, so in that sense, that would be deregulation. Instead, what we have is the government saying you may not, you know, and
yes.
that actually what
yes.
I'm doing is technically illegal, though what they don't want you to do is go to a frequency and stay there and keep broadcasting there without permission. If you just set up in a guerrilla fashion and communicate on one frequency for a few hours, who's going to know? You know, it's not going to get back to – it's not unenforceable. That's the point.
Yeah, geographically the area is so vast and you sort of count on the government of being unable to be there when you are.
Yeah, it takes them, I think, a couple of months to send the guys in suits down there.
And a couple of months to care.
Minimum.
FreeRadioBerkeley.org is the site.
Right.
Let's get back to you, and let's get back to a little bit of your sort of transitional history back from where we left you off, which was in the 1980s.
Great. Actually,
our guest, by the way, is Chris Brown. I haven't said that in the past few minutes.
Okay. Mid-80s, I started working a lot with a couple of great musicians who were also involved a lot in the Bay Area new music scene, William Winant, percussionist, and Larry Oakes, who is one of the saxophones in Rova Saxophone Quartet.
Right. Great group.
And
heard on Calvus and Damien.
We had a group called Room during that period, which was the three of us to begin with, supplemented eventually by an electronic music composer named Scott Gresham Lancaster, who has worked as a technical director at the Center for Contemporary Music and currently at Hayward State University. Very interesting composer, experimenter with electronics. What happened in that group is we started out as an improvising group, and I was playing my electroacoustic instruments. And gradually, they were such virtuosos on their traditional instruments that I started jonesing to get back to the piano,
uh-huh.
and I started playing the piano too. But I wanted to keep it sort of extended, so I brought in the electronic transformations first on my own equipment, and then I started thinking, well, this would be interesting if I start to pick up sounds from the other instruments. So this was an interactive electronic music group with three improvising players on acoustic instruments. And we did some great concerts, I think. We did one of the highlights was we played at the MERS Festival in, I believe it was 1989, which is a great festival of new music that's in Germany, you know, for thousands of people. And I had a little Macintosh computer on stage, and it was monitoring input from pitch followers and changing the program that was transforming their sounds as they played. And it was all a very feedback, you know, information feedback-oriented kind of thing. And what happened is I was designing these pieces for the group was that it got too complex for me to operate and play at the same time. So eventually Scott was operating the controls and sort of mixing the music, which became a big part of it. And we put out a few CDs and had a little nice run with that group for a while. So that was a big part of my interest. I was composing pieces that involved electronic programs that were interacting with improvising musicians, and then there were notes. You know, I would write.
There were notes.
There was the traditional music part, very closely melded with the electronic part, and that was.
Tell me about improvisation, and improvisation was not a primary concern for quite a number of years. It would come and go, but we've seen a dramatic rise of it in the past 10, maybe 15 years in new non-pop. Why is that? What has happened?
I don't know. I mean, to me, it always seemed like a natural thing. There was kind of an element in the Cage and the post-Cage generation. Or basically, John Cage was not liked to distinguish between what he was doing, which was indeterminacy, mm-hmm. and improvisation. And it seemed to me that you know, he had some points to make, and it clarified something about what he was doing. But I felt that some of the new music world took that as a dogma, and felt that they needed to distinguish what they were doing as composition from improvisation. And I think there was a little bit of a, classical, non-classical class issue that was involved here. Mm-hmm. People don't take you seriously in the, quote, serious music world if you're an improviser. And all of this comes down to cultural and social sorts of issues. And I was a bit confused by that because I loved the Cage tradition. But I also loved improvising music traditions. And so I sort of tried to ignore the issue, kept improvising, and moved. From the late 70s, I was doing improvising. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of the people who became prominent in the late 80s and 90s and the improvised music movement were doing it the same way. A lot of them were involved in jazz in some shape or form. And I was a bit confused by that because I loved the Cage tradition. But I also loved improvising music traditions. And so I sort of tried to ignore the issue, kept improvising, and moved. From the late 70s, I was doing improvising. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of the people who became prominent in the late 80s and 90s and the improvised music movement were doing it the same way. A lot of them were involved in jazz in some shape or form. I wound up playing with a free jazz group, the Glenn Spearman Double Trio, which kind of morphed out of Room at one point in the early 90s. We added another drummer and Glenn Spearman, who was an incredible saxophonist who played with Cecil Taylor. And I'd always been a Cecil Taylor fan. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, Cecil Taylor and Henry Cowell, they're part of the same idea. Now, I think a lot of people don't feel that way, but they're a part of my world, and I felt that they both fit in it in the same kind of area. So, I don't know. To me, there was never, in my music, it was never an issue. It was something I wanted improvisation to be part of it. I want the musicians to be active, creative part of the music making. I still think the composer has a role with the idea. You know, the composer creates ideas and brings things to the musicians. But I personally have never really been interested in the idea that the great performer, is a recreator only. You know, is only realizing the idea of the composer. I want the performer to take the idea and take it somewhere and put their own musical imagination and spirit into it. And then as a performer, because I've always been a performer as well, it's better music to me. There's more interaction going on. There's more life in what's going on stage. So it's just the way I've embraced it as part of my musical practice. And I think, you know, audiences, especially younger audiences growing up with rock music and jazz music being music that they know, I mean, this is music based on improvisation on one level or another, also on composition, you know. So from my point of view, it's just kind of coming around, and that issue that sort of was holding up something in the late 70s, early 80s is going away.
And so it's not that the process of improvisation has increased necessarily, but the visibility has increased because the sort of denial has begun to slip away.
Yeah, I think the reason for denying, it really has to do, the reason for denying it has gone away,
yeah.
And I think that basically the politics has changed,
mm-hmm.
and generations have changed. And, you know, I mean, you have great performers and composers of written fixed music like Frederick Shevsky, who's also an incredible improviser.
Yes.
And we have to get over this idea that somehow if you're improvising, it's lesser than if you're not improvising. Because I think from most of our points of view, it's clearly not. Improvisation is an incredible aspect of all music making and was when the classics were created. And somehow between, 1880 and 1980, there seemed to be the idea that music was going to be frozen or something, even though it never was.
Maybe it was hand in hand with recordings.
With recordings. That's another long topic we could go into.
Let's hear something.
Okay. Let's see. What will it be?
So what have we got? What are we about to hear?
Let's hear Hall of Mirrors from the CD by the same name with the group Room.
Here it is.
Okay, so maybe I should steer towards...
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Chris Brown, and you're listening to the Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar. It's your one stop for non-pop on the Non-Pop International Network.
Here on WGDR Plainfield. The Calvos.
The Calvos.
I wondered about that. Well, suddenly we were the Calvos and Damien's New Music. How did that happen?
I guess we got better.
we got a definite article.
Yes.
I don't know why we're so definite, but all right. We were listening to music by Chris Brown. We were listening to Hall of Mirrors. And we should pick up our interview after the Hall of Mirrors. And Hall of Mirrors.
It's not like the Hall of the Mountain King. Mirrors.
No, it's something for Halloween, I think.
Oh.
Hall of Mirrors. Ooh. All right. Back to the interview. Back to beautiful downtown California.
I'm ready.
Here we go.
I guess it's Chris Brown we've just heard from Room. What are you doing now with your... You talked about building instruments long ago. What are you building now?
Well, we talked a little bit about this transmissions piece. So
sure.
Instrument building has... The transmission system was an instrument, an instrument, I consider. So I'm really sort of expanding the idea of what an instrument is. So it's not really been a physical instrument so much in the last decade for me. I've also gotten involved a lot recently in software synthesis. So I'm building instruments by programming them. I use the Super Collider programming language that James McCartney began and is now a free software synthesis system that...
You see Super Collider everywhere in projects that are from students through composers who have been working for years.
Well, it's a nice model, I think, for the way that this development should go in that he's made it free and open source.
What is it exactly? Give our listeners
It's a set of software tools which include oscillators and filters and all those kinds of synthesis modules that you use in writing programs that you can then play. You play them either by typing commands on a keyboard, a computer keyboard, or you can control them using MIDI or any of another, other kinds of controllers.
Live sensors inputs and just about anything that you can get to the program can be used as a controller.
Right. Yeah. Right. And it's not an easy system to use. I've been at this point programming computers for doing music for almost 20 years in one form or another. So starting from nowhere, I mean, I really didn't have a technical background that way. Now it's very familiar to me, and I enjoy it. And programming is a creative activity. So a lot of the instruments I'm building now are software systems that include samples and oscillators and things like that that I perform. I'm performing in a group now called Fuzzy Bunny, which is a trio with Tim Perkis, who was one of the members of a group called The Hub. Now, this is another historical thing.
Yes, it's another story, and we've heard other people tell us about The Hub.
Oh, okay, good. Yeah. Well, there is a website about The Hub for anybody interested that's on the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art site, /crossfade, sfmoma/crossfade, and you'll find a lot of video and sound and stuff about that. And I worked on that a lot last year. But anyway, Tim Perkis, Scott Gresham Lancaster, and I are in this trio, and what we're doing now is sort of pilfering all kinds of popular culture for samples and creating an improvised music that's a cut-up, sort of DJ-like music made with computers. And Scott actually plays a guitar through a rack of synthesis gear. It's kind of it's a serious music based on pop sources. What you find is all these pop songs for the last 30 years are like triggers in people. They have the same kind of emotional effect that a chord used to have. You know, when you play a diminished chord, everybody would feel mystery, or a minor chord, okay, feel sadness. Now, when you play Heard It on the Grapevine, everybody gets that wistful kind of, feeling. And if you play just two bars of it, they know what it is.
I think John Oswald with his Plunderphonics really delves into the constant stream of memory triggers that we have, sonic triggers.
Yeah, he definitely is the pioneer in that.
Yeah.
And we're sort of following along as a live version of that. We're improvising.
Did you get into trouble ever on this? I mean, we've got such an intellectual property morass going on right now with that's my sample. That 1.3 seconds yeah. is mine. It'll cost you X.
Well, you know, we're not on Sony Classical or on any of the major labels, so we're kind of flying under the radar. And yeah. if we ever, you know, got to the point where somebody wanted to release it in a big commercial way, I'm sure we'd have a lot of dues to pay.
There's yeah. there's groups like Illegal Art, which are working hard to a negative land,
right.
Working hard to yeah. say, look, there are some places where if you go there with iron-bound intellectual property rules, what you're going to do is trash the creative seeding that has gone on in music for centuries.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is unstoppable at this point. The idea that recordings are replicas, and that means that they're easily replicated. And especially with digital versions of them, I don't care what kinds of copy protection they put in place, it gets defeated within a few days after it's been released. So I don't see, I think there is a different, you know, it needs to be a different paradigm to have musicians be able to make money. But I mean, none of us are going to be able to invent it. It's something that's morphing out of the natural growth of these systems. And you know, I read recently an interview with a musician in China where, of course, 95% of the CDs that people listen to are pirated. And they basically just take the point of view in creating a CD that this is a way for them to get performance gigs. Now, there's something nice about that. You know, it's ironic. I mean, it's too bad there's not the big recording contract, but how many musicians really have benefited from that? Not that many. But now the idea in making a recording is that we get to play live because people know our recording and they want to do that, and we get paid for our live performances. In a way, that's kind of a righteous return.
It is. It's an interesting turn of events. Let's hear another piece, and we'll come back and ask a few more, maybe final questions even.
Let's see, what should we hear? How about if we put in a little bit of this piece called Lava?
Okay.
This was kind of a milestone for me, where
all right.
after doing all this work with improvised signal processing and improvisers, I had a grant to make a long piece, and I made it as a quadraphonic installation piece. With four brass, I had a grant to make a long piece, and I made it as a quadraphonic installation piece with four brass players and four percussionists,
uh-huh.
all scored and with the electronic effects meticulously
electronic
composed.
Electronic offense, I like that.
Okay, you're right. They're all meticulously planned, sort of worked out in a sequencer. It's a one-hour piece. It's called Lava. It was designed to sort of imitate the flow of that hot molten material that in this case percussion instruments and brass players could provide. So let's hear a bit of that.
We won't hear all of it. We'll hear some of it. Lava. Our guest is Chris Brown.
Who skipped back there? That was rather odd.
It was doing some lava. It was erupting.
It sounded like it. All right, let's go to it now. Let's hope that this doesn't skip.
The hand soap.
Excerpt from Lava by Chris Brown.
The Hands Hope.
Yeah, and there's lots of folks on there. There's William Winans on there. And who else is on this CD?
You'll tell us momentarily.
Momentarily, yeah. I know it was produced by John Zorn. There's somebody we should get on the show.
Sure.
Huh? Yeah. It's got Tioji Tamita and Tom Dylan and Peter Varhoftik on it. So available on Tzadik, one of those unusual labels that produce a very small number of odd little pieces. So let's go back to our interview. We're going to wrap it up next week, but let's listen to the interview and a little piece that's after that. In the meantime, we remind you that next week we'll finish up Chris Brown's interview, and then we'll begin our interview with Ernesto Diaz-Infante.
It's also Ernie.
Ernie.
Yeah, Ernie.
Nesto. Let's call him Nesto.
Yeah. Ernie.
And he's a young feller who's chronicling his compositional life.
He's chronic what?
Chronicling his compositional life on CD. Basically, he releases a CD every few months of his latest work, and he plans to do that for his, and he's only like, what, 24 or something. It's really sort of an interesting state of affairs with because you hear the development from month to month of this guy's works. Anyway, so that's next week, and then after that, Cindy Bishop and Peter Gerard. John Truby, Margriet Hunderdos coming up. Who else is coming up? Other folks. Gosh, just goes on and on, doesn't it?
Seems never to stop.
And we'll have some announcements next week as well. Let's go back to talk a little bit more with Chris Brown, and we'll listen to his piece Naughty Spence after that, and we'll be back next week.
From Lava, our guest is Chris Brown on Calvis and Damien. You teach.
Yes, I've been teaching at Mills College now for about 13 years, something like that, and at the Center for Contemporary Music, which grew out of the San Francisco Tape Music Center. And we have a wonderful continuing tradition of a homegrown new music resource that the San Francisco Tape Music Center was. We now are getting the archives, all of those archives, up and available. And we're hoping it'll really be something that we can continue to create a historical and tradition, you know, a tradition for that means something in the whole history of experimental music. I mean, one of the things way out here on the left coast is that you realize that the things that happen here don't really get into circulation in the same way that things are that happen on the East Coast. They just don't.
Is that true?
I think it's pretty clear. I mean, of course, New York is the magnet for all of the attention and for the business. So if you're doing it in New York, it gets distributed. People hear about it faster. You're doing it on the West Coast, part of the glory of it is actually that you don't have the glare of the media, and you can really experiment without feeling that what you're doing is, you know, prepared for the market. And that's both good and bad. You know, it makes it harder to market it and be self-sustaining, but at the same time, you have more space. You can take time to make experiments and have failures. And you know, in a certain way, I think there's a reason why John Cage and Henry Cowell and Harry Parch and a lot of the people who were really experimenting a lot wound up out here or started here. Or, you know, it's a breeding ground, I think. And you know, so we're on the other hand, we're trying to establish that there is a tradition and there is a continuing tradition in the Bay Area that's meaningful and that has been important. And so at Mills, we try to carry that on. And we have a graduate program that brings in students from all over the world who are interested in participating in that kind of way. Fred Frith teaches there now, but we're talking about a tradition that had Anthony Braxton there and Terry Riley and Robert Ashley and on and on. I don't know, there's a CD that has examples called on it of the current residents at Mills, which include Alvin Curran, right. Fred Frith, and sure. Maggie Payne, who I think has been here, and Pauline Oliveros, who's still affiliated with our faculty. And it's called Oasis, so maybe we can listen to a track from that,
great.
Too.
Great.
Thank you. A production of multimedia.